Media.
Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas and Go at the Y, and Gas and Go at Mill Bay.
It's nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it is your public radio station. We're broadcasting from here on Signal Hill, where it is 56 degrees. 55 degrees out at the airport right now, where they are showing wind speeds at 10 miles per hour from the northwest, 10 miles of visibility. Mostly sunny skies called for today with a high near 56, northwest winds to 20, partly cloudy overnight with a low of 38, northwest winds to 10, and mostly sunny skies tomorrow with a high near 53. They are calling for mostly sunny skies and sunny skies until Saturday. Coming up on the KMXT Midday Report, Providence is sending out a survey.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Family members who lost loved ones in the Buffalo mass shooting, now under investigation as a racially motivated hate crime, are in anguish and angry as new details about the alleged gunman suggest early warning signs might have been missed. Despite a previous threat against his high school and a subsequent psychiatric evaluation, this year the alleged gunman was able to purchase the firearm that authorities say was used in Saturday's shooting that claimed 10 lives. Garnell Whitfield Jr. lost his mother, Ruth, on Saturday.
What I love most about my mom is how she loved us, how she loved our family unconditionally, how she sacrificed everything for us.
At a news conference today, he and others wept as the attorney representing them called on officials to define Saturday's massacre as an act of domestic terrorism allegedly perpetrated by a self-described white supremacist. Day after the Buffalo massacre, there was another mass shooting at a Taiwanese church 3,000 miles away in California. Authorities say the suspect, identified as David Cho, was a Chinese immigrant motivated by hate for Taiwanese people. One person died, five were injured. Buses and trams are running today in Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, for the first time since Russia's February 24th invasion. NPR's Jason Beaubien reports far more people are on the streets as Russian forces have been driven from the outskirts of Kharkiv.
Due to the rapidly improving security situation in the city, Kharkiv's mayor declared that he's restarting 4 light rail lines, 8 trolley buses, and 25 bus routes. In the center of the city, Beznikov Valery, who was waiting at a bus stop, says the return of the buses is a beautiful sight. After weeks of getting pounded by Russian attacks, he says ordinary life is now able to resume in Kharkiv.
Yeah, much, much safer, and I must say it actually feels good now here.
Many of the buses and trams, however, were damaged by Russian shelling. Due to shortages of replacement glass, some of the vehicles are operating with plywood covering their windows. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Kharkiv.
A senior defense official tells NPR today that Russian and Ukrainian forces continue to exchange artillery fire in the Donbas, calling it a real gunfight. The official added that Russia is not making any significant territorial gains. The airspace remains contested, with a general wariness on the part of the Russians to fly into Ukrainian airspace and encounter Ukrainian air defenses. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 26 points to 32,223. The S&P was down 15 points, and the NASDAQ was down 142 points. It's NPR News.
NPR News es presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. The body of 7-year-old Sawyer Sipola, who went missing near his home off Menashka Bay Road in Kodiak more than a week ago, was found on Pillar Mountain on Sunday, according to the Alaska State Troopers. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports.
Sipola's body was discovered by two adults recreating in the Pillar Mountain area on Sunday afternoon, according to an emailed statement from the Alaska Department of Public Safety. No obvious signs of foul play were identified at the scene, according to the release. Agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation had also not uncovered any evidence of foul play during their time on the island last week, according to the Alaska State Troopers. Sipola was autistic, and in the week he went missing, more than 2,000 volunteers canvassed 10,000 acres of steep and rugged terrain across the island looking for the boy. Alaska Wildlife Trooper Josh Boyle was the incident commander for the search. He spoke at a press conference on the case held the day before Sipola's remains were found.
It was both humbling and awe-inspiring to see the magnitude of generosity displayed over this last week, truly defining what it means to be a community and a family coming together in a time of tragedy.
Boyle said local businesses donated flashlights, bear spray, and food and water for searchers. The search effort also included Kodiak Island Search and Rescue, Coast Guard Base Kodiak, U.S. Navy SEALs, and local pilots. Canine teams were also flown in from across the state to assist in the search. Lieutenant Paul Fussy is the Alaska State Troopers statewide coordinator for search and rescue.
As a SAR coordinator for the state and as Alaska State Trooper for over 20 years, I've never seen a more thorough and complete search for a missing person during my career.
The investigation into what happened to Sipola is ongoing, according to the DPS statement. Meanwhile, in an emailed letter to parents, Kodiak Island Borough School District Superintendent Larry Ledoux said counselors would be available for students who need support throughout the week. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobroth.
Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center is sending out a survey in Kodiak in an attempt to identify areas where it can improve the general health of the Kodiak population and to stay ahead of healthcare needs. KMXT's Dylan Simard reports.
Kodiak residents may have seen leaflets recently raising awareness for a survey on health and well-being. According to Providence, it's part of an ongoing effort to evaluate the healthcare needs of a community and then work to meet those needs.
We, of course, have access to patient data and those who walk through our doors when they have an acute problem, but we don't have good line of sight as just to where the larger community is in their health and well-being. And so we field a community survey really to get responses from the broader community.
That's Nathan Johnson, Regional Director for Community Health Investment for Providence. He says that the survey is performed every 3 years and was last taken in Kodiak in May of 2019. A lot has happened in the healthcare world in the last 3 years. The COVID-19 pandemic made thousands of people in Kodiak ill, and an ensuing mental health crisis has stretched waiting lists for psychiatric services into multiple months. Johnson says that these changes demand an updated survey.
This is a completely new survey over what was done in 2019. This survey is referred to as the Health and Well-Being Monitor. It is a survey that was developed by the Providence Institute for Healthy Communities in collaboration with the University of Washington.
Results are analyzed by Providence and shared with partner groups, including other healthcare providers in the Kodiak area and local government. That information then gets used to identify problem areas for healthcare providers in Kodiak to tackle. That analysis is expected to be completed no later than September. The survey runs till the 31st of May. Cash prizes are available for those who participate. The survey can be found at the Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center website, and mailers distributed around the island have a QR code that links directly to the survey. In Kodiak, I'm Dylan Simard.
Two times each year, volunteers from around the Kenai Peninsula grab their waders and gloves and head to the Kenai River. They're collecting samples that will help paint a picture of how the river's doing in that moment in time. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Like any good patient, the Kenai River gets an annual checkup. That's the analogy that environmental scientist Ben Meyer uses to explain the Kenai Watershed Forum's twice annual water monitoring project. The forum just wrapped its spring monitoring session, sending six teams of volunteers to points all along the river and its watershed.
So some teams go out really early at like 6 a.m. and ride a boat out to some fairly remote spot in the river. And some teams are just almost walking out their back door to the docks down at the City of Kenai boat launch.
The idea is to have a simultaneous snapshot of the health of the river along those different points. And after taking samples, volunteers send them to labs where they're tested on variables like pH, temperature, and for the presence of metals and nutrients. The Watershed Forum's been doing that baseline monitoring since 2000, since the organization started. So there's over 20 years of data to look back on.
So anytime we're trying to understand something we observe now in 2022, we're looking back and comparing it against the last 20 years of data.
Sometimes that data results in action. About 15 years ago, analysis on the river showed an increasing presence of hydrocarbons, the pollutants that typically come from gasoline and oil. The main source of those hydrocarbons was identified as two-stroke engines from boats on the river. And at the time, the river was listed by the Environmental Protection Agency as an impaired water source. So the Watershed Forum and the Kenaitse Indian Tribe funded a motor buyback program. Boat owners could get vouchers for four-stroke engines, which have lower polluting potential, as long as they turned in their old two-stroke ones.
So after that program was implemented, within a few years, there was a pretty dramatic decrease in hydrocarbons, and the main stem Kenai was delisted as being an impaired body of water for hydrocarbons, and yeah, it is no longer the case.
Over the last two decades, the forum streamlined the technology it uses to take measurements. For volunteer Kathy Klein, one thing has remained the same all these years: the joy she finds in those twice annual monitoring days.
I still get excited thinking about it, you know, the first time going there and doing it, and always look forward to it. It was always a challenge, you know, to get to some of the areas.
Klein's been volunteering since the project's inception. Back then, they take measurements year-round. She remembers wading into frigid water and seeing dead moose floating in the creek.
Doing the pH testing and the titration, and you felt like a real scientist and doing something good for the community and the river, which is a vital part of the community here.
This spring, she took data at Funny River, Moose River, and Morgan's Landing. The Watershed Forum office sits right near one of the sites at Soldotna Creek Park.
So we're standing a little bit further up on Soldotna Creek now. This is one of the sites that's been monitored for the last 22 years.
Monitoring starts with a quick check for any variables that might make this year's data different. This year, for example, there's a new fish weir sitting nearby. Meyer puts on gloves and takes several plastic bottles out of a cooler.
I'm going to have my field partner reach in and grab the first bottle. Usually the first sample type we collect is fecal coliform.
That's bacteria that comes from animal waste. Meyer wades over to the riverbank.
Then we would just swoop it into the water about 6 inches deep and then try to get the line right kind of just above 100 milliliters there.
Get that's the repeated four or five times, and then samples go to labs for analysis.
Sure,
the Watershed Forum logs its data online in an EPA database, along with data from watersheds all over the country. The whole process can take months.
Although there's only 2 days out of the year where this field work happens, it's really a year-round project to keep going.
Meyer says they can always use more volunteers for future monitoring, like the session this summer. If you're interested in volunteering, you can email ben@kenaiwatershed.org or call the Kenai Watershed Forum's office at 907-260-5449. In Soldotna, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The dispatch center that handles 911 calls for a large area of the interior is restructuring operations to provide relief for overworked staff. KUAC's Dan Bross has this report.
The City of Fairbanks-run Emergency Communications Center answers 911 calls from around the interior and dispatches first responders from 21 police, fire, and EMS departments from Fairbanks and North Pole to Nenana, the Denali Borough, and Delta Junction. Center manager Christy Meredith says the operation is struggling to recover from a slow transition from in-person to online dispatcher training forced by the pandemic.
It took them about 6 months to come up with how they were going to do that, and then we were able to hire people, but it has still affected us a lot.
Meredith says 12 of the center's 17 and a half dispatcher positions are currently filled, and two of those employees are in training. She says the situation requires dispatchers to routinely work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, or more.
The way it has worked for the last couple of years, there's a lot of mandatory overtime.
Meredith says the schedule and stressful nature of the job take a toll.
There are quite a few of them that have come to me and said, I don't know how much more of this I can take. Their personal lives are suffering. They don't have relationships. They're just trying to go home and go to sleep so they can come back again.
In an effort to provide a better work-life balance for dispatchers, Meredith says the center is transitioning to a 4 days on, 4 days off, 12-hour-a-day schedule and reducing the number of dispatchers on duty.
We are going to drop our manning to two dispatchers instead of three on a shift, and the third person is going to be a call taker. So it'll be a little less training in the room, but it will give people a little more time off.
In a presentation to the Fairbanks City Council at a meeting Monday, Meredith said the new arrangement will result in delays.
People will be on hold waiting for somebody to answer the phone longer. This will mean that officers will be put on hold and wait a little bit longer for the dispatcher to be able to cover their traffic. Same thing with the fire departments. There will be a delay in what we're doing because we can only cover so much at a time.
Meanwhile, the city is actively trying to fill the open dispatcher positions. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Along Alaska's rail belt, utilities and their customers depend on one important substance, natural gas from Cook Inlet. Hillcorp is the major supplier of that natural gas used to generate electricity and heat people's homes. But according to utilities officials, Hillcorp says it may not meet those high natural gas needs during the next contract cycle. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Homer Electric Association General Manager Brad Jankorski said in his most recent report that while Hillcorp says it has enough gas to fill existing fuel contracts, it doesn't have firm gas available beyond that. That shift in supply will have different implications for different utilities. Chugach Electric, for example, powers Anchorage and parts of the Kenai Peninsula. And natural gas from Hillcorp makes up about 50% of its current supply, says spokesperson Julie Haskett.
Our contracts with Hillcorp extend through March of 2028, which gives us some time to look at other sources.
Other contracts are up much sooner. Homer Electric's gas contract is up at the beginning of 2024, and natural gas from Hillcorp makes up much more of its supply.
86%. So it's a pretty significant number.
Homer Electric spokesperson Carrie Ann Baker says it's true the utility could have been more proactive about finding other fuel sources. But she says the news from Hillcorp doesn't mean the co-op will be left high and dry the moment its contract runs out. Instead, she says it's a start to conversations about the future of the relationship.
I think one of the questions that we have received from a couple of other people is, are we concerned about running out of gas? And, you know, in the short term, we just aren't.
It wouldn't be the first time an oil and gas company has sounded the alarm about natural gas supply in the inlet. About a dozen years ago, the state sent tax credits to oil and gas companies on the North Slope and in the inlet to subsidize production amongst shortages. And that's also when NSTAR built the Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage Facility. Oil and gas watcher Larry Persily was a legislative staffer at that time. He thinks Hillcorp's notice is an indication that it wants to take stock of its investments before embarking on new projects in Cook Inlet.
I think this is a notice from Hillcorp that they need to have the conversation with utilities. How much gas do you want? How many years are you willing to sign for? What's your future demand? And then Hillcorp would go out and find that future supply, all the while everyone knowing that future supply is probably going to cost more than the old supply. That's just the way it works.
He says there's a lot of caution worldwide from companies in new investment. Globally, demand is up for oil and gas, while supply is low. That's why prices are so high at the moment. But before companies make investments to up that supply, they want to make sure they're investing in the right places.
Oil and gas producers are not reluctant, but a little cautious about putting billions into new projects that may not produce until 2030s, because they really don't know where the world is going with fossil fuels, oil and gas demand, climate change, and they don't want to be stuck with an investment into something that the world needs, but really not as much as they used to, and it doesn't make money for their shareholders.
Meanwhile, utilities say they're forming a working group to talk about electric reliability in South Central going forward. Haskett, with Chugach Electric, says the group was also formed in recognition of the ongoing decline of assets in Cook Inlet and the current rise of interest in renewables. Whatever the group decides, Baker says Homer Electric doesn't want to be focused on just one source of energy. But it's been hard for them to find suppliers when they've put out requests for proposals before.
And we only had one person come back and give us a quote, and that's Hillcorp. And they're great. Like, we enjoy working with them. They run a great business. This isn't an anti-gas thing or an anti-Hillcorp thing.
But she says the concern is what will happen if something goes wrong.
You know, that is a very vulnerable position for people to place themselves in.
She says that's one of the major reasons Homer Electric's been trying to diversify with renewable energy sources. The company set a goal to reach half of its energy needs with renewables by 2025 and is in the early stages of several renewables projects today. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
We're told to drink lots of water, and we've also been told that we should be drinking water that's filtered and pure. Well, I hate to tell you, but many plastic water bottles contain chemicals called phthalates, which can leach into bottled water. Phthalates are known to disrupt testosterone and other hormones, which can lead to abnormal sexual development, male infertility, premature breast development, cancer, and miscarriages. The bottled water company successfully opposed the FDA's proposal to regulate phthalates in the bottled water industry. Bottled water is often no healthier than tap water, but it can be 10,000 times more expensive. Approximately 25 to 45% of bottled water sold in the United States actually comes from municipal sources. Additionally, there are no requirements for bottled water to be tested for parasites or disinfectants. Bottled water companies are also not required to notify their customers if elevated levels of contaminants are found. The production of plastic water bottles in the U.S. alone creates 2.5 million tons of carbon dioxide, a key greenhouse gas responsible for global warming. To make a plastic bottle takes twice as much water as fits inside the bottle. And for many bottled water companies, choosing a location with access to large markets for their company is more important than the quality of water. Americans empty 2.5 million plastic water bottles an hour. Each one takes 500 million years to decompose. Is it just me, or is my garden hose looking better and better? Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
To better serve our community by understanding its needs, the 2022 Kodiak Health and Well-Being Survey is now open to Kodiak residents age 18 and older. The survey results help healthcare and social service providers focus on what is most important to those of us who live and work on the island. It also helps attract grant funding to help improve health and social services. The survey is anonymous, takes about 10 minutes, and can be completed on a smartphone or tablet. At the end, participants can opt to enter a drawing for a cash prize of up to $500 by emailing their contact information. Look for a survey invite in this week's mail or access the survey on the Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center website.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 16th day of May, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 5:43. It won't set again until 10:29. That will give us 16 hours and 45 minutes of glorious daylight. a gain of 4 minutes and 2 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was 30 degrees. That was set in 1966 and 2006. And our record high was 76, set in 1942. Currently 57 degrees out at the airport under fair skies. They have wind speeds from the northwest at 12, gusting to 21 right now. 10 miles of visibility. We're looking for mostly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high near 56, which we've gone right by. Northwest winds to 20. Partly cloudy tonight with a low around 38. There's going to be a full moon tonight. Northwest winds to 10. Mostly sunny skies tomorrow with a high near 53. North winds to 5. And they're talking about partly cloudy skies overnight and mostly sunny days till Saturday. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up at 3:24 this afternoon. Here on the east side, that will be a 7.5-foot tide. That'll be followed by a low tide at 8:43 this evening of 1.6 feet. Over on our west side, you have a high tide coming up at 3:46 this afternoon. That will be a 13.8-foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 9:28 p.m. of 2 feet. Mariners, pretty nice weather out there. From Marmot Island to Sitka at Kodiak's east side, they are calling for northwest winds to 15 knots and seas to 4 feet today. For tomorrow, variable 10, seas to 3 feet. In the Shelikof Strait, west winds to 15 knots and seas to 3 feet. For tonight through Tuesday night, variable 10, seas to 2 feet. And for Wednesday in the Shelikof, west 15, seas to 3 feet. For inside waters, Chiniac Bay, northwest 15 today, seas to 2 feet. For tomorrow, north 10 in the morning, becoming variable less than 10, seas to 2 feet. And up in Marmot Bay, west 15 today, seas to 2 feet. For Tuesday and Tuesday night, variable less than 10, seas to 2 feet. The Kodiak Public Broadcasting Board of Directors will hold their next regular meeting tomorrow, May 17th at 6:30 p.m. via Zoom. If you'd like to sit in on the meeting, please call the station at 486-3181 or send an email requesting access to gm@kmxt.org, and a link will be provided to you before the meeting. The Kodiak City Council will be having a work session on Wednesday. That meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. and being held in the public library. The meeting is open to the public, and public members are encouraged to web stream. The web streaming link and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. For those who wish to request printed materials or have questions about the meeting, contact the city clerk at 907-486-8636. You are invited to a Kodiak Pride rock painting party. Please join the Kodiak Pride committee for a fun afternoon of painting rocks. It will be used in collaboration with upcoming Kodiak Pride events. Sponsored by the Coast Guard Enlisted Association's National Office, rocks and painting supplies will be provided, but feel free to bring your own. That's happening next Saturday, May 21st, at the Nimitz Gazebo on Old Tom Stiles Road, and that's going on from 12 to 2 p.m. Again, next Saturday, the 21st, Nimitz Gazebo, 12 to 2 p.m., paint some rocks. The Kodiak Community Blood Drive is coming up. That will be happening between Thursday, May 26th and Monday, May 30th. It's happening at the Alaska Army National Guard Armory. That's at 125 Powell Avenue. To schedule your appointment, call Tara Cup at 907-654-9419. On Memorial Day, the 34th annual Sourdough Pancake Breakfast is happening. That's going to benefit Kodiak 4-H, and it will be held at the Elks. Show up between 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. on Memorial Day, Monday, May 30th, and have $10 in your hand, and they'll let you in to eat lots and lots of sourdough pancakes and fixins. It's only $10 for people 11 and up. Youths 4 to 10 are $5, and children under 3 eat for free. The Kodiak Public Library is hosting a community beekeeping project this summer. Check out their many books on everything bee-related and attend a live hive check every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Call to reserve a spot outside with the beekeeper, or you can watch from inside. For more information, contact Ani at 486-8683. And on Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m., don't forget about the Lego Club. It's a drop-in program for youth after school. Children under 10 should be accompanied by an adult. Thursday at 3 p.m. is the library's next chess club meeting. Drop in to learn, practice, or sharpen your chess skills in a cozy, friendly environment. No experience is necessary, and it's open to all ages. And again, that's Thursday, 3 p.m. at the library, chess club.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.